awkward questions. I'm staring at my phone. I'm staring down at a number that I don't recognize, and the Jays game is on, and I don't know what to do because I'm expecting a call that I need to take, but I don't recognize the number. I'm worried it might be important, so I decide, okay, I got to pick up. I answer, hello? And I hear on the other line, hello, is this Brad? I'm like, yes. He says, well, Brad, are you ready to start dancing? I'm like, take the phone away. I'm like, start hitting myself because I've been avoiding this call for 6 years. So you have to back up a little bit. 6 years ago, it was our Chris and I's anniversary was coming up, and I wanted to inject some romance into our relationship. I'm thinking, what could we possibly do? It'd be great. So I was like, I know, I'm going to go and I'm going to get us dance lessons. I am going to buy us private dance lessons. And so I did. Gave them to Kristen, and we sort of looked at these dance lessons, and she sort of thought to herself immediately, she was like, this is very romantic, because our very first date, we took salsa lessons. And so she's like, very romantic, but then we kept putting it off, and then eventually Kristen just said, I have no interest in doing dance lessons. And I thought to myself, I don't really have any interest in doing dance lessons either. So they sat there for 6 years. And this lady has been calling me. Sometimes she'll call every week. Sometimes she calls every few months. The last time I talked to her on the phone, I told her to call me back in the fall. I said, not a good time. Call me back in the fall. Sure enough, she did. So now I'm on the phone with her and the Jays game on and I'm stressed out. I'm like, I got to just get off the phone. She's like, well, when do you want to start doing your dance lessons? I was like, Wednesday? And she's like, sounds good. How's 8:30 sound? I'm like, okay, that sounds good. So right now, Chris and I are on the line for dance lessons this Wednesday. But I had this great thought. I am going to will my dance lessons to you. What? No. I'm going to will them to you, Bronson. You are going to be able to take these dance lessons. It's going to be on you. But it was so awkward, right? When do you want to start dancing? I hate awkward questions. I hate awkward situations. And I mean, here's the thing. Awkward conversations, and in particular, awkward questions, they just do me in. I can't stand them. And in my experience, there is one awkward question people hate facing more than anything else, and that's the meaning question. Nothing, it seems to me, kills a conversation quicker than lobbing out there, what is the meaning of life? And if you don't believe me, just give it a try this week. Just subtly just slip it in. While you're talking about the Jays, just be like, speaking of the Jays, do you think life has any meaning? People will, they'll just clear out of the room. It's so awkward. Asking questions about meaning in life almost seems to embarrass people. And if you do throw it out there, you get labeled one of three things. You're either A, lacking in social skills, B, someone who is far too serious, or C, someone who's just plain weird. Like, who brings that up in conversation? And it's so bizarre to me because in my experience, people seem to have no problem talking about politics, sex, religion, anything. They'll talk about anything, but you throw the meaning of life question out there and people are like, well, that's a little awkward. Last week, we began our religious narcotics series. We introduced ourselves to the Masters of Suspicion. And we allowed their voices to critique faith and religion because for them, especially Freud and Nietzsche, this world, this cosmos, life as we know it, is indifferent and hostile. But the awkward weight of thinking about how life might not have any meaning or that the cosmos might be indifferent towards us is something very few of us ever take the time to contemplate or think about or worry about. I mean, who has the time or energy for that, right? And so for the Masters of Suspicion, faced with a universe that is indifferent to us, void of any meaning, religion and faith, they step into the fray and they drug us. They numb us. They convince us there is meaning. And it numbs that pain and anguish we feel about the world. Religion is a narcotic. And many people today have rejected religion and faith because of that. They don't need the drug. Or do they? Enter Ernest Becker, stage left. As Becker joins the conversation, something interesting happens because in his book, Denial of Death, a phenomenal book, he suggests that the Masters of Suspicions, they didn't take things far enough. Religion might be our narcotic, he says, but humans are inherently religious, and so it's not just faith that's a narcotic. Culture itself acts as a narcotic. And he goes on to claim this: those who have rejected faith and religion have simply replaced one narcotic for another. And what Becker argues is this: anyone who has any kind of worldview or life project that makes life comprehensible to them or provides a sense of meaning and significance, they're wide open to the same criticisms that the masters of suspicion launch at the religious folk as well. When I was traveling, I took my father-in-law's sleeping bag with me. And I was like, great, I'm going to camp, I'm sleeping out in the back of a truck, I'm sleeping out in the wild in this sleeping bag. And it was so windy one night, the whole thing just kept flapping, kept me up all night. I'm in the back of a truck and flapping. Like, this thing's a piece of garbage. This sleeping bag doesn't work at all. And so the next time we stopped at a gas station, I just threw it in the garbage. Like, this thing's useless. I know. It wasn't good. And then I get home, and he tells me it's a very expensive sleeping bag and that I have to replace it. And so I have to head out to Walmart. I bought a cheap one. He said it wasn't quite as good. But I had to go out. The very thing that I had rejected and thrown away, I had to go back out and buy the exact same thing. And this is what Becker's saying. Those of us who have thrown out faith and religion, you've rejected it. And then if you have any sort of worldview or life project, you've simply gone and replaced it. For Becker, everyone is religious. Everyone is a fundamentalist. It's simply a question of finding out what your fundamentals are. And so this morning, my goal is this: let's find our religion. Whether you're religious or not, spiritual, atheist, agnostic, doesn't matter. This morning, our goal is this: we're going to find our religion. And so I hope you're game. Hope we're okay to go here. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to rely a little bit on the wisdom tradition within Scripture. We're going to rely on some other voices to help us do that. But I'm going to give you a sequence of five questions to help you find your religion. Three of them will be quick, and then we'll sort of dive into two of them more deeply. But let's start with Jesus. That's always a great place to start. Head to the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, he's speaking under the mantle of the wisdom tradition. And I want to focus in on one piece within the Sermon on the Mount. This is what Jesus says: do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Now granted, the masters of suspicion would have a heyday with this. Say, there it is, evidence, religion as a narcotic. Jesus is pointing to a soothing, narcotic afterlife. But I want to approach this right now just as a wisdom teaching, particularly that last proverbial line: where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And if you want to find your faith, what you believe, your religion, this is a great place to start. What do you treasure in life? Where is your heart ultimately? What is your heart passionate about? What is that thing or things that you most value in life? Or let me change the lens for us slightly in hopes it'll help us hone in, I think, on what Jesus is talking about. Paul Tillich, he argues that everyone is inherently religious. Everyone has a faith. It's just finding it. And Tillich, he says this: faith is the state of being ultimately concerned. What are you ultimately concerned about? I know some of us were concerned, right, with how high our hydro bills are. That's not what I'm talking about. What is your ultimate concern? Think through that, find that, and you found your religion. Or ask yourself this question: what is life worth living for? I mean, outside of Netflix and all that stuff, when you really stop to think about it, what is life worth living for? Answer that question: why you get up in the morning, why you do the things you do, why life is worth living. Find the answer to that, and you have your faith. Because here's the thing: the moment you place ultimate value on something, the moment you give something your ultimate concern, the moment you find that thing that makes life worth living, you have entered the realm of faith. What do I mean by that? Let's change the lens again just slightly. Consider the book of Ecclesiastes. It's central to the wisdom tradition within Scripture. For those who are familiar with Scripture, what we often do is we like to jump to the end of the book. But what I'd suggest is this. If you come at Ecclesiastes like a fine wine or scotch, something that you sip and don't rush, it changes its effect drastically. The book helps you find your religion and faith pretty quick. Here's how the book begins. This is the first few sips. Let this roll over your tongue. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem, meaningless. Meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. How does that one taste? Ugh, a little bitter. I, the teacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on humankind. I've seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless. A chasing after the wind. Ooh, still a little bitter. And what the book does is it then sequentially goes through all of the various things that humans do, our activities, and essentially the author finds them all meaningless. Work, pleasure, meaningless. And so if you want to find your faith or your religion, ask yourself this question: where do I find meaning in life? Or better yet, flip it. Where do I resist the notion that everything is meaningless? Where does the notion that everything is meaningless make you defensive? That's the key. Where does this make you defensive? When this notion is pressed, does it begin to piss you off? Because if you can locate that, you'll have found your faith. So let me push some buttons this morning. And I'll start with me. I, at various times, you know me, you can make fun of me anytime you want, right? Like, I don't mind being the object of a joke. But there's one thing that I tend to get defensive about, and it's my work. So occasionally I'll hear people say things like, what a waste of time. Like, really? That's what you do? Like, you speak? Like, the whole talking head thing is dead. Nobody learns via lecture anymore. Like, what you're doing is kind of meaningless. And you can make fun of me in any way you want, but this area, I start to get annoyed. Really? That area starts to push my buttons. And why? Because it betrays my faith. This is what I do. This is meaningful for me. And so when you attack that, it exposes my faith. Or work. Imagine I came up to you, and it doesn't matter whether your work is a job, a hobby, what you do in your spare time. But if I came up to you and said, your work is completely meaningless, you might start to get a little annoyed. All of you working, you're like Sisyphus pushing his stone up a hill. You're just bound to do it again and again. Teachers, what are you doing in the classroom? Like, what a waste of time. I can't believe you gave your life to teaching. Like, it makes any sort of difference. Right? You say, well, whoa. Or what about our artists here? We got a lot of artists here, musicians, artists. What is it like to consider the fact that all the hours you've put into your discipline mean absolutely nothing and contribute absolutely nothing to our world? Bit of a waste of time. It's meaningless. Your art? Really? It's meaningless. Right? That starts to, huh. Okay. Because it's easy to read Ecclesiastes and be like, oh, this is an interesting book. Everything's meaningless. Yeah, but when it's applied to those defensive areas, it's like, whoa. Or stay-at-home parents. Man, all those mind-numbing hours of boredom and frustration for nothing. Like, oh, jeez. Your existence is meaningless. Like, really? Really, Brad, you're going to go there? I'm just putting on the hat. I'm being the antagonistic one. Or all of you in the room, look at you working for social justice. We have so many people here working for social justice. As if it matters. It would be adorable and cute if it wasn't tragic. All that time you put into pretending you're actually making a difference in the world. It's meaningless what you're doing. Right? That stuff starts to, okay, now you're grating on my nerves a little bit. So the question is this, where's your button? Where do you start to get defensive? Figure that one out and you'll have found your faith in religion. What parts of your life do you insist are meaningful? No. Wasting time on Netflix, sure, that's not meaningful. But this is meaningful. Find that, and you found your faith. Because here's the thing. The moment you ascribe meaning to something, you have entered the realm of faith, of religion. And this is the key to the previous questions as well. The moment you place ultimate value on something, the moment you give yourself something that is of ultimate concern, the moment you find that thing that makes life worth living, the moment you declare life has meaning, you have now entered the realm of church and faith. Let me explain it this way. I think I've showed you this piece of art before. It's one of my favorite pieces of art. It's by an artist named John Bramblett. And John Bramblett is blind. And for this piece of work, he got out a bottle of Merlot, and he tasted it, and then blind, he created his taste experience. And back in April, I emailed him. I had no idea if he would reply to me. I emailed him, "Hey, John, I'm a fan of your work." He emailed me back. I was like, "Oh, my favorite artist emailing me back." And so I said to him, because my daughter's middle name is Merlot, I emailed him and said, could I commission a painting? He's like, "Yes, you could." I'm like, whoa. Could you take a bottle of Merlot that I chose and create a piece of art around that? He said, "Yes, I could." This is the greatest thing ever. So I go to Kristen, "Hey, this guy's going to do a piece of art for us." And her very first question was, "How much?" I said, "Well, okay. It's going to cost $3,000. But listen, honey, this has great meaning and significance for me. What a great keepsake to give to our daughter." She's like, "No chance, no way, no. Like, "What are you talking about? This is the greatest thing we could ever have." I was showing her the painting. She's like, "It's meaningless. It says nothing to me. It's an array of colors." I'm like, "Wow, you're killing me, honey. Really?" She's like, "It's a blob of color. You, Brian, your abstract art drives me crazy. We have very different sensibilities, different aesthetics when it comes to art." I'm like, "Really? Really? This is so meaningful to me." She says, "It does nothing for me, and there's no chance for spending $3,000. So anyway, if any of you got $3,000 kicking around and you want a, nice little present for me. This is the thing, abstract art, next slide. Here's the thing. Abstract art is one of those incredible things because some people look at abstract art and say, "What? It has no meaning. There's nothing there. Children could do this. Why do we give abstract artists any sort of credibility?" And then others of us say, "Oh, I love it. I love it. There's a feeling. There's a meaning there." And this is essentially the question we have looking at the world. And there's two points of view. Either you look at the world like this and say, "Nope, nothing there. It's meaningless." Or you say, "Oh, it's full of meaning." But to do that requires an act of faith. And you see, for Becker, he says, religion might be a narcotic, sure, but that doesn't go far enough. Culture itself is the real narcotic because it invents meaning. It says, "Here's meaning. And let us provide paths for you to find meaning." Becker sums it up well here. He says this: "This is what a society is and always has been. A symbolic action system, a structure of statuses and roles, customs and rules for behavior designed to serve as a vehicle for earthly heroism. Each script is somewhat unique. Each culture has a different hero system. Each system cuts out rules for performances of various degrees of heroism. It doesn't matter whether the cultural hero system is frankly magical, religious, and primitive, or secular, scientific, and civilized. It's still a mythical hero system in which people serve in order to earn the feeling of primary value, cosmic specialness, ultimate usefulness to creation, unshakable meaning. They earn this feeling by carving out a place in nature, building an edifice that reflects human value." In the end, for Becker, culture is a religious narcotic. In the face of a meaningless universe, culture steps up to say, "We'll create meaning for you. Yes, the arts are meaningful. Yes, parenting is meaningful. Yes, justice is meaningful. All you got to do is find your path. Find your path to meaning." And you see, where we enter the realm of faith and religiosity is when you start believing there's meaning in this world and in our lives. Consider on a very personal level, self-esteem. Self-esteem. Here's the last key question to finding a religion. What is your self-esteem built on? Ask yourself what your self-esteem is built on, and you'll have found your faith in religion. I'm fascinated by terror management theory, TMT. Fascinating field of study. And one of its core questions is this: why as humans are we so intensely concerned with self-esteem? And TMT suggests that we're intensely concerned with self-esteem because it gives life meaning and significance. And so for them, self-esteem is a cultural narcotic. And it consists of this underlying belief: one can be a valuable contributor to a meaningful universe. And the equation has two parts. If this world is meaningful, I feel good about myself when I'm contributing to it. It gives me self-esteem. I'm valuable. But if I don't feel like I'm making a valuable contribution, I suffer. My self-esteem suffers. That part makes sense. But here's what Ernest Becker calls the vital lie. If you take out the meaningless universe part, then there's no such thing as a valuable contribution. He says, culture invents meaning for us and then invites us to contribute to it. And our self-esteem is built on the lie that we're contributing to something meaningful. But in the end, like abstract art, there might be no meaning there at all. If religion is guilty of being our narcotic, so is much of culture, including our self-esteem. You might be thinking, this is nonsense. Well, TMT researchers, they set out to provide some empirical evidence for this. And these guys are like mad scientists. I have no idea how they get away with this stuff. But they wanted to see how people would respond to existentially disturbing material. So they set up a study. And they brought a control group in, and they had them watch a video of an autopsy being performed. Come in, watch an autopsy being performed, and then can you describe in a questionnaire for us afterwards how you feel? How did that make you feel, seeing a body chopped up after it's dead and dissected, all that stuff? As you might imagine for this control group, they come in, they watch an autopsy, they're like, whoa. They reported feelings of great anxiety. They reported fear. They reported that it reminded them of their mortality. And they reported having to ask themselves some really hard questions about the meaning of life. So that's the control group. Fair enough. So then they wanted to test an idea. If self-esteem functions as a narcotic, a defense against existential anxiety, maybe if you increase somebody's self-esteem before watching the autopsy, it will reduce anxiety. So that's what they do. Bring in the next group of people, and they have them do a personality test and an IQ test. After they're done, they lie to them and say to the whole group, you scored remarkably high on your personality and IQ test. In fact, our testing shows that you're incredibly charming and intelligent. Oh, thank you. Who doesn't want to hear that? Now that you know you're incredibly charming and intelligent, would you mind watching the autopsy footage? Fair enough. They watch it. Afterwards, what happens? You guessed it. Less anxiety, less fear, less questions about the meaning of life. People bolstered by high self-esteem. I don't need to worry about that. That doesn't freak me out. Self-esteem protects us against existential anxiety. Self-esteem, our self-esteem tells us we can be a valuable contributor to a meaningful universe. And armed with that idea, we seek out these pathways to build up our self-esteem. And we try to get ahead and try to work away at our past, except when the veil dissipates for a moment. Irvin Yalom tells a great story about this. He says this: not too long ago, I was taking a brief vacation alone at a Caribbean beach resort. One evening, I was reading, and from time to time, I glanced to watch the bar boy who was doing nothing save staring languidly out to sea, much like a lizard sunning itself on a warm rock, I thought. The comparison I made between him and me made me feel very snug, very cozy. He was simply doing nothing, wasting time. I, on the other hand, was doing something useful, reading, learning. I was, in short, getting ahead. All was well until some internal imp asked the terrible question: getting ahead of what? How? And even worse, why? I don't know about you, but I can certainly relate to that. There are those moments when the cultural narcotics wear off. It exposes the faith we have put in our own self-esteem, getting ahead in life. And in those moments, we're faced with tough questions. We feel the full force of the opening words of Ecclesiastes. Everything's meaningless. What if everything is meaningless? What if everything I am doing is just built on sand? And in these tough and sobering moments, these moments thankfully pass quickly. We all have these moments, but they pass quickly. And then we're able to get back to life, get back to mowing the lawn, doing our favorite pastimes, getting ahead, working on this sermon, back to Netflix. Just another little shot. But in those moments when the veil dissipates, it troubles us. And thinkers like Ernest Becker, those working with TMT, they've expanded the masters of suspicion notion about religion. They've applied it to all of culture. Human culture is inherently religious. Human culture gives us meaning and significance in the face of an indifferent and hostile cosmos. Human culture makes religious fanatics and fundamentalists of us all. We hold life is worth living. We believe life is worth treasuring, pouring ourselves into. Our orthodoxy is that life has meaning. We're invited to contribute in a valuable way. This is all of our faith, because none of us could go on thinking life was meaningless. And so maybe we're all under the influence. Maybe everything is meaningless. Maybe Macbeth had it right. It's gone. All right. Macbeth says this, Shakespeare's Macbeth. Life is but a walking shadow, poor player, that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It's a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Maybe it's not just the religious who are idiots, but every single one of us parading around our life projects, pretending our time on stage actually means something. And so you see, as we move into our religious narcotics series, you see, we strip everything away, because any discussion of faith, it has to start here. When everything is stripped away, the question isn't about whether religion is a drug, but whether the very idea of a world with meaning is a drug. And ultimately, how we see the world, believer, atheist, skeptic alike, it boils down to one fundamental question. It all starts right here. Is the cosmos indifferent and hostile, or benevolent and loving? Is the cosmos unsympathetic and heartless, or compassionate and kind? And how you answer that question shapes everything. Because here's the thing. If it is indifferent and hostile, then we're all under the influence. If it is indifferent, it doesn't matter whether you're religious or not. My faith in imaginary God is about as absurd as the person who believes in the imaginary concept of meaning. Both are equally crazy. And so it starts with this fundamental question. Is the cosmos indifferent and hostile, or benevolent and loving? But if there's a center, some sort of glue or gravity, if the cosmos has some kind of meaning, then we have a place to start from together, religious, atheist alike, fundamentalist, skeptic alike. And what I love about the Apostle Paul is that he was every bit as much a philosopher as he was a theologian. And I like ultimately how he saw the world. Consider this passage. You might have heard this at a wedding or two. It's the end of the love chapter, 1 Corinthians 13. It says this, "For now we see only a reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love." For Paul, his honesty is sobering here to me. We don't know. Maybe this is all smoke and mirrors. Maybe it's all a delusion. Maybe we're all under the influence of narcotics. Who knows? Because as humans, we can only ever see in part. We can never fully know. This is the plight of humanity. But then his conviction, which I share, and I ask you to gamble your $2 on as well. For Paul, when everything's stripped away, when the illusions of this world are laid bare, when everything that is temporal is gone, in his mind there's going to be three things left. Faith, hope, and love. For Paul, this is what is real. I'm going to ask the band and Murray to get ready to come and close with a prayer, but what Paul is saying is this, the illusions are many, but there is something real. There is such a thing as truth. This is where the story begins. This is the answer to the question of the cosmos. In our world, is it indifferent Or does it hum with meaning? And for Paul, what is real, what is true, where the story begins, what the universe ultimately boils down to is three things: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. And this is where I want to start from. This is where I want to bet the $2 of my life and place it hard on that this world does have meaning and that I can contribute in a meaningful way. And could that be a lie or an illusion? Yeah, it could. But that's where I'm starting from. And if we started there, then we might have something to build on together. Let me leave you with the words of sociologist Michael Casey. It says this: once we say yes to love, we can begin to follow the logic of transcendence, the logic of going beyond ourselves for someone or something more important. We can stop anywhere along the way and not go any further, and this is a constant human temptation. But if we keep ourselves at it, a whole new world slowly begins to come into view. That's where I want to start. Start there. And I'm hoping this fall we can continue following that path, saying yes to love and seeing where that takes us as we continue to explore religious narcotics and into the fall later as we explore some specific things about the Christian faith. But it all starts there. How do you see the world? None of us know. Is that art full of meaning, or is it meaningless? You got to make your bet at some point. I'm putting my $2 on love.